Support for Science Friday's podcast comes from Squarespace, the award-winning website builder that helps you share your story with the world. Start a free trial at squarespace.com/Friday. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Earlier this week, a toy drone made a bit of a splash when it crashed onto the south lawn of the White House. Now, that particular model would only run you about $500, but you can pick up some tiny ones for really under $50. And while these diminutive drones are largely the realm of hobbyists, this kind of intrusion once again raises questions of personal security and privacy. The FAA, which regulates drones, even advised people headed to the Super Bowl to bring their money and their good cheer, but not their drones.
Going to the big game? Have fun, cheer on your team, and keep it a no-drone zone. Don't spoil the game. Leave your drone at home.
Yes, we live in a world where the Super Bowl has to be declared a no-drone zone. Drones are becoming ubiquitous, but how much do they threaten our privacy or security? And can our privacy laws keep up with the drones and the other rapidly evolving robotic technologies? Ryan Kalo is Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Washington in Seattle. He specializes in robotics, and he joins us now from KUOW. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
What was your reaction when you heard about that drone's crash landing onto the White House lawn?
Well, I got to be honest. My reaction was, this is why we can't have nice flying things. I got worried that that regulators at the federal level, all over this different states, would want to immediately fashion rules to try to limit what hobbyists and others do with their drones.
Shouldn't there be some rules about that?
There are rules, right? I mean, so the Federal Aviation Administration sets a few parameters and guidance for how you can use drones as a hobbyist. What happened at the White House wasn't okay under existing law, right? I mean, you have concerns about trespass. You have specific rules about flying in D.C. And so I think there are rules in place, and I think it's just that people have to be responsible with this technology.
So you're saying we don't need special rules just for the drones?
Well, look, I think that in order to do what the Federal Aviation Administration has been charged by Congress to do, which is to integrate the domestic use of drones into the commercial sector, that is to say, allow companies and startups and individuals to use drones for business purposes, well, yeah, there should be some rules around that. I think that there should be a way to test whether they're safe enough and to really vet people's business models and plans. But I don't know that there should be real specific rules for drones, like a toy drone that you could buy from a store for a couple $100s. I think people just need to be sensible in how they use the technology.
Well, what if somebody says, you know, I think it's sensible to put a camera on my toy drone and fly it over your backyard during your holiday party, taking pictures of everyone there?
So I teach torts at the University of Washington, and there's a couple that get implicated when you start to spy on people with any technology, including drones. You know, there's the intrusion upon seclusion tort, which says that if you engage in enough, you know, an outrageous enough behavior and invade people's privacy, they can sue you. And if you fly low enough, you can be said to be trespassing on my land during my party. You know, there are lots of places where the law is not going to be adequate to address the problems that drones and other robots create. But that scenario is one where we actually do have some recourse in the courts already.
Mm-hmm. Does a law for drones or recourse in the courts, do they apply, you know, to all kinds of robots? We have not only drones, but we have all kinds of robots happening now. Are there regulations to regulate them, or do we not need that because there are laws already?
Well, certainly in certain instances, we do have rules that govern robots specifically. So we have driverless car rules in Nevada, for instance, and we have these different state bills that address drones. I guess one thing I want to make sure listeners understand is that, you know, drones are make certain things easier and less expensive and so forth, like surveillance by police. And so we might worry that they'll do more of it and maybe too much of it. And privacy law is actually not really up to the task of putting limits on police use of drones. in all circumstances. But it's not just drones, Ira. I mean, there are all kinds of robots that can do essentially what drones can do without necessarily flying around. You know, there are robots that climb the side of buildings, for instance. There are robots that can one robot that's developed by Boston Dynamics, which Google purchased, can jump like 40 feet into the air and land on top of a building. There are these balls that have all these photography mm-hmm. capabilities that you can throw. So there's all these ways that you can invade people's privacy with technology today that are not drones. And I think we need to address all of them together.
Well, would that include a satellite up in the sky that takes a picture of my backyard the same way a drone could? Is that an invasion of my privacy?
I think that's a great example. I think that the truth of the matter is that surveillance technology in general is outpacing the protection of the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. And it doesn't matter whether it's a drone or a satellite or some of these other technologies that I'm alluding to. Our laws just are not in sync. And you see that in lots of different places, and not just in robot technology. I think what's different about robots is the fact that our reaction to them is so visceral. It's so easy for us to sort of picture the drone flying over our house or the drone following us around. It's a privacy invasion that is not so different from some of these others, but it's easy for us to visualize and be worried about.
Because it's very personal. You know, it's a little flying object that's... You've seen them in the horror movies and things, you know, things getting out of control. It's coming over your house or, taking pictures of you or whatever. And it's a sort of a one-on-one thing, whereas a satellite, you don't think about it, or you don't think about the blimp coming over your house during the Super Bowl, that sort of stuff.
Sure. I mean, in general, it's very hard for consumers and citizens to picture what privacy violations look like, because it's like these pieces of data are being correlated somewhere, maybe, or someone far away is sort of looking. I mean, it's just very hard for us to visualize. But with a drone, it's this flying inscrutable robot that we know is looking at us, and so it creates in us a mental model of surveillance. And in that way, I think it's a positive, Ira, because I think it's really catalyzed a public conversation about privacy in a way that no technology has before.
Well, let me ask you're a lawyer. Let me ask you this question.
True.
We won't hold that against you.
Reformed. I'm a law professor. Yeah.
if I see a drone buzzing over my backyard and I swat it down with a broomstick, is that my legal right to do that?
That's a great question. So I think, and a common, I think, misconception. So what would happen is if you had a drone flying over your property and you were to knock it down, throw something at it, a rocket, or hit it with a broom, you might be actually sued by the person who owns that drone for damaging their property. Now, of course, you yourself would also be able to sue them, maybe for creating in you some apprehension that you were going to get hurt if it ran into you, for battery, for trespassing on your land. But they might be able to counterclaim. Now, an exception to that would be if you were actually felt like you were being reasonably threatened by a drone, if a drone were rushing at you or you were really worried about it. Well, then in that instance, you could invoke self-defense. And then, but there's an open question, which I think is really interesting, about whether or not you can use self-defense to protect yourself from privacy. And I do this robotics law and policy conference every year. And last year, Michael Frumkin and a co-author, he's another law professor, wrote about whether you could take a bat to a drone for spying on you and came to kind of a mixed conclusion.
Well, you could, one of these states that have stand your ground laws.
Yeah.
Couldn't you apply that to a drone?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I know that some places are being pretty creative. I mean, Deer Trail, Colorado, you might have heard, was issuing drone hunting licenses.
Oh, I hadn't heard about that. But
yeah. I mean, and of course, a man in New Jersey did shoot a drone down that was hovering over his property. But, recall that he was criminally prosecuted for that action. I think that we can understand people getting nervous. We can understand people trying to protect themselves and their property. But just because there's a new technology in your space doesn't mean you can take any action you want.
Mm-hmm. What if the GPS in the drone, it's trying to figure out where it's going. It's on GPS and it fails. And it falls down on one of your kids or something, or it just lands and frightens you, is that then the drone maker's fault, the person who's controlling the drone's fault? And, this is a field day for lawyers, is it not?
It is. It is. So I you know, this is the stuff that I really, you know, study very closely. With drones, there's a couple different kinds of things. So if the drone is, you're supposed to be flying it around, and all of a sudden it unexpectedly falls out of the sky, and you, the operator, weren't doing anything particularly wrong, then you're going to be able to go after the manufacturer, and you're going to say, look, this thing's supposed to be safe. It wasn't. And we can sue them in negligence or whatever. I think the really interesting questions start to come when you treat your drone like your smartphone or your personal computer or your tablet, where you actually get third-party apps for it. So not long ago, you know, a couple months ago, Facebook, the company Facebook, apparently had a hackathon to program drones. And they got a Parrot AR drone, which is a particular inexpensive drone quadricopter. And they wrote programs for it because it has an open API and you can write stuff. So that's where things get really interesting and complicated, where you have a drone and you have somebody using it and you have a third-party software, that like an app that somebody wrote, who could be a big corporation or could be some kid in a garage or somebody in another country. And all of a sudden, it's very difficult to figure out what went wrong. I call this the problem of open robotics, because while it'd be wonderful to be able to get a drone and have it do all kinds of interesting things people can program, it really muddies the waters when it comes to product liability.
But don't people love to have this settled? The manufacturers, all the people, wouldn't they like to have some sort of legal ruling that sort of starts to make the law for this?
Well, I've argued that we ought to actually immunize manufacturers of open robotic systems, meaning robots like drones and other platforms that you can write third-party software for. Because if you think about it, that's what makes these kinds of platforms, these kinds of technologies, so useful. You buy it not just for what it can do, but what it could do. And the same thing with the robot. You buy a robot, all it has to do is pass the neighbor test. You know, I mean, when you get a huge box delivered to your house and there's a robot out of it, your neighbor's going to come up and say, "Why'd you get that?" And you need to have an answer. You know, I need it to help my aging father. I need it to help this. You know, you have to have an answer. Yeah. But then after that, it can do anything people can program it for. Okay. So I've said, look, let's immunize open robotic platforms for the things that users do, like we immunize, say, Facebook for what users do on Facebook.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Quite interesting. Ryan Kahlo, Assistant Professor of Law, University of Washington in Seattle. We'll all be looking up at the skies. We're going to take a break, talk about how secure your credit card is, and look at the chip and PIN and Apple's new pay technologies, mobile payments, all that good stuff. When we get back after this break, don't go away. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Last fall, hackers stole 56 million credit card numbers from Home Depot. Credit card companies are introducing chip and PIN or EMV technology to update the insecure magnetic strip on the back of that little card. President Obama introduced the Buy Secure initiative to outfit government payment terminals to support the new cards. Apple introduced a different system said to be even more secure. Well, will this technology, will all of it actually make us safer? How does Apple Pay and mobile payments play into this? And would any of this technology be able to protect against the breaches of stolen card information at Home Depot and, of course, remember, Target? My next guests are here to help us sort through our wallets, walk us through some of these new technologies showing up at a cash register near you. Robin Seidel is a senior special writer at the Wall Street Journal here in New York. She joins us at our CUNY studios. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello there.
Hello back at you. Nanette Burns is the senior editor of business reports at MIT Technology Review in Boston. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thanks for joining us. And if our listeners have any questions about chip and PIN technology, mind to be secure. Any questions you have, please, you can phone us at 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Let's talk about some of the ABCs of what's going on here. Robin, how do these chips work differently from the magnetic strip that we have on our credit cards?
Basically, the cards have a computer chip embedded on them, and you can see it right on the front of the card, and it creates a unique code for each transaction. And so the point is that when people break in and steal card data, they're usually stealing the data to create counterfeit cards. Since there's a unique transaction for every a unique code for every transaction, the information on the card is pretty much has no value to the thieves.
So I'm not giving out any of my personal information or the number of the credit card and my name on it?
Right. The magnetic stripe that we're all used to has static information. Mm-hmm. It's got a ton of information about you, your account number, your expiration date. With a chip, there's a code, and that code changes with every transaction. So the bad guys won't get that information.
Mm-hmm. And more banks are going to the chip and signature option, though. They want you to still sign something.
Yes, this is a big issue within the banking industry. Everybody refers to chip and PIN, because that's what's used around the rest of the world. But most of the banks in the U.S. are using chip and signature because they think that a PIN is going to be too difficult, too much of a disruption for mm-hmm. consumers, and they want them to use a technology that they're used to.
Now, Nanette, Apple Pay is sort of a rival to this system, is it not? What is the difference between Apple Pay and these other systems?
Well, the difference between Apple Pay and any card that you would use with a chip or without a chip at retail is that the card information is not actually even stored on your mobile phone. They have a special way of coding your credit card so that the information on your Apple mobile phone is not the same as your credit card number. So if somebody breaks into it, they don't even have access to that credit card number. Now, the difference is, of course, that you're using a mobile payment, so you have to use a point-of-sale terminal where you can actually just hold your phone up to the terminal and send a signal.
And instead of a signature, it's using your fingerprint that it has built into the iPhone?
Right, in the case of Apple Pay.
Yeah. Fingerprint technology. Is it considered to be any more secure, Robin or Nanette, than the other?
Well, I think one of the big concerns in the card industry, and let's be clear, Apple Pay kind of rides on the infrastructure of the traditional payment system. It's just a different way mm-hmm. of paying, but it's still a Visa card, a debit card, a MasterCard that's linked to it. But it certainly is... people think it's more secure because one of the things that people are trying to avoid in the industry is merchants storing your data. This way, merchants don't even get your card information. They will get what's called a token that is held by the bank or is held by your card network. So the merchants won't have your data. If they don't have your data, the bad guys won't break in.
And then, Ed, if you're standing at the checkout line, you have the choice between Apple Pay and a chip and PIN card. What would you choose?
Well, I am not currently using Apple Pay, so I would have to use a chip and PIN card myself. I think for people who like the sort of technological element of using your fingerprint and, the kind of stares of admiration you might get from your fellow checkout folks, that, the phone's equally secure to the chip and PIN, I think. One of the questions security experts, I think, bring up wisely is, as more people move to mobile, the bad guys will start to focus more on trying to figure out how to hack that technology, and then is when we'll really learn what the potential weaknesses are.
The spy versus spy sort of thing. Would the Home Depot and Target, would they have been breached had Apple Pay or Chip and PIN been around?
Technically, yes.
They would have.
They could have been. The question is, if there's nothing to steal, will anybody break in? So that's the question. Technically, yes, it could still have been breached, but the bad guys wouldn't have gotten anything. So you've got to assume that they might have less, there's less motivation to break in.
Mm-hmm. Some companies are looking at the location data to make mobile payments more secure, Nanette, right?
Right. And that's interesting. That could be a little controversial, of course, also because it starts to tread into questions of privacy and so on. But yeah, some new companies are trying to use data from a variety of sources to assure that you, the person holding that card, trying to use that card at a checkout, mm-hmm. is actually the person who's supposed to be using that card. And location data is one of the things that they look at. Transaction history is another one to try to figure out. Could you actually execute a trade at this spot if you just did one, 15 miles away a minute ago?
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. Our number, 844-724-8255. David from Stamford, Connecticut. Hey, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much. I got a question about the chip cards. I actually have a few chip cards that I've gotten over the last year or so. And I've noticed a lot of terminals now will accept them, or there's a slot for that. But I've been trying to use it dozens and dozens of times. It never works, and the clerks have no idea what's going on and say, oh, you just slide it through instead. So why is it that we've got the infrastructure out there, but it's not being used, and when is it going to be used?
Robin is laughing.
Yeah, because it is actually funny because I hear that all the time. So there's a couple of factors at play here. First of all the merchants are upgrading their technology so that it does have a slot, so you will insert the card with a chip versus swiping it with the kind that you've got, the traditional kind with the magnetic stripe. The problem is that just because the merchant has the technology at the point of sale doesn't mean it's turned on. So that's one thing. If it's not turned on.
Wait a minute.
Yeah. Right.
Is it because they just forgot that day to turn it on?
You know, it really depends on the type of merchant. Some smaller merchants get told by the people who sell them this equipment that they need the equipment, but they don't realize that they're supposed to flip the switch. If there is an active terminal to accept a chip card, then the chip card will work. If they tell you to swipe it, it just means that their technology is just not working. And it's a real issue sometimes with the clerks who, you know, if you got a 15-year-old kid or something, they don't know what's necessarily going on, although there are increasingly prompts for both the customer and the clerk to help guide you through the process.
Wow.
But I think that...
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, I think that raises an important point, which is this technology is not in every checkout yet, and the technology that, the type of point-of-sale terminal that can allow you to use your Apple Pay is also not in many. In fact, it's only, I think, in about 220,000 across the country right now, which is really a fraction of how many registers are out there.
David in Syracuse has a comment on Apple Pay. Hi, David.
Hi, great program today.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
Appreciate you having me on. Just wanted to skip back to the Apple Pay real quick in terms of the level of security that I think just needs to be focused on that wasn't touched on before. And that is two-factor authentication, which is really part of the Apple Pay solution, which includes a thumbprint along with tokenization. It's something that has not been seen in any point-of-sale solution thus far. So to equate it to a traditional credit card transaction is really not doing quite the amount of service that Apple Pay deserves in terms of what it offers the customer.
Let me
go ahead.
No, I've got a comment on that. That's a good point, Robin. Minute.
I think the banks are trying very much to multi-factor authentication. Authentication is something that everybody's trying to pursue to double, triple check that you are who you say you are. What I was saying before was just that it's riding on the rails of the traditional infrastructure. That's all.
And it's interesting about the two-point system. It could be applied all across your credit cards because you can now have you get a notification when anybody makes a payment. Right on your credit card, and it will you go to your cell phone and tell you somebody has been paid, and you can go back and check it as sort of the second point.
I was in Texas last week, and I got denied at the point of sale at a department store, and which surprised me. And I immediately did get on my and I was using a card, a plastic card, and I immediately on my phone got a text from, or it was maybe an email from my issuer saying, "Hey, are you really in Texas?"
Well, so
that's multi-factor authentication as well.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of
and
which,
another,
I'm sorry.
Sorry, another interesting part of Apple Pay that I think a lot of people have really liked is that anytime your card is used, if your card is registered through Apple Pay, but you use it separately, you know, the actual physical card somewhere, you get an automatic alert on your Apple Pay account. So that let's say somebody got your card and was using it illegitimately, you'd figure that out potentially even before your bank did.
Talking about using your cards remotely, I want to just bring up a study that was released this week out of the journal Science, maybe you're familiar with it, that found that just three pieces of credit card information, like your credit card receipts, your time and your place of purchase, are all that are needed to identify the person behind the credit card. The study is actually entitled The End of Privacy, and it implies that a belief that you can have privacy is really only a myth. Any reaction, Robin, to this study?
I mean,
do you know of the study?
Yeah, I heard a little bit about it. But frankly, I think that kind of goes across all of the way, all of society now anyway. If anybody's expecting that anything that they have is personal and held private, that's kind of a fallacy.
Is this the new, this is the new real now? Don't expect privacy anywhere?
You know, to some degree, I think that it's certainly the driving force behind all this focus on security, and people are increasingly worried about security when it comes to mobile payments. So it's a concern, but at the same time, it is the world we're living in.
Mm-hmm. And people like convenience, right? So people, there are a lot of people who like the thought of only going out with their phone and not carrying a wallet, not carrying cash, and not carrying plastic. And so for them, something like Apple Pay or any kind of mobile payment like technology is helpful.
President Obama talked about instituting for the federal government security.
Right, and services. He actually has ordered chip and PIN cards, which has the industry a little bit in a little bit of a tumult since they've all been focused on chip and signature cards. So that's going to be really interesting to see what happens there.
Yeah, let's go to Malcolm in Wasilia, Alaska. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, I was wondering how liability would change switching over to the chip and PIN system. I heard say you're card does get stolen or something along those lines, if that's actually compromised in some way, the customer could be liable for that.
Hmm. Let me just remind everybody that this is Science Friday from PRI, and we're talking about a little puzzling question. Liability. We talked a lot about having a lot of legal opinions this hour.
I don't think there's really any chance of liability issues on behalf of the consumer. What is happening in October right now, banks are on the hook. Every time there's fraud, banks pay for that fraud. As of October, the liability will shift to the merchants. Merchants need to have these upgraded terminals to accept these chip cards.
Is there going to be a shakeout in one system? Is one system going to, is like Betamax and VHS sort of question? Nanette, what do you think?
You know, I don't think so. I think it's unlikely. First of all, cash is still used in the majority of retail transactions in the U.S. today, and 85% of the transactions around the world. So cash is still very popular. I don't think this spells the death of cash. I do think that as people move towards mobile payments, they'll be using cards less. But again, I don't think that cards are going to go away entirely. They're so convenient, and people are so used to using them. So if you can make them more secure with the chip and PIN or chip and signature, then, you know, that's a big improvement, and I think many people will feel comfortable with that.
But so you don't think we need a system? You know, whenever any new technology comes out, whether it's VCRs or Betamax, whether it's now we have electric cars from multiple, sources and none of the chargers fit each other— now we're going to have multiple pay that you have to have one kind of pay that's not standard. You always think that sooner or later it might shake out to having one dominant pay system. What I hear you saying, Annette, is that may not happen.
Well, as I think Robin made the really important point, that the backbone to Apple Pay or Loop Pay, or any of these cards is the payment systems. The processing systems done by Visa, MasterCard, Discover, they are still the authenticators of your identity. They're the ones guaranteeing the transactions. And that system, I think, if anything, has been a little bit strengthened by Apple Pay coming in and offering a way for people to keep using that. So it's like the interface is changing, but the backbone isn't that different. So I'm not sure, if I would imagine different interfaces could continue to work with that same backbone.
Mm-hmm. Visa and MasterCard don't care if you use a card or Apple Pay because they get paid every time you make a transaction.
But might they get paid more from one than the other?
Well, right now the banks are actually paying to be on the Apple Pay system, but they think that the increased number of transactions that they're going to see because people like using Apple Pay will offset those costs. Who knows? There are other systems out there that try to skirt the traditional system. And those are a little bit more questionable. And I think a lot of that has to deal with what consumers are comfortable with. People are very comfortable with all their, as much as people complain about their banks, they are comfortable with their banks having all their financial information. And they may not be as comfortable with a no-name company having access to their money.
Are there any models in Europe that this has happened before now and we're watching to see how it works? Or is it new all over the place?
Well, I mean, Europe and around the world has been using chip and PIN for many, many years.
Yeah, that's what I was asking.
Yeah, and that is the way that transactions that transactions are done.
All right. We're going to watch how they're done here. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. Robin Seidel, senior special writer at the Wall Street Journal, and Nanette Burns, senior editor of Business Reports at MIT Technology Review. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about how to make a prediction at the Super Bowl. I'm not going to tell you how. It's a different, you know, everybody has methods for betting. There's a new method that we're going to bring in and talk about and see if it might work for you. So stay with us. We'll be right back. We're not telling you to do any betting, but in case you do, stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Hey, podcast listeners, take a look around. Chances are, if there's something stunning, you'll stop and stare at it for a while. That's the power of Squarespace, a sponsor of today's podcast. Its platform is easy yet powerful, so you get superior engineering and high functionality when you want it. Everything is mobile responsive, so your website looks elegant in any size window. And because you're a Sci-Fi listener, you can try it for free at squarespace.com/Friday. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. People are making big predictions for the Super Bowl this Sunday. And, you know, bettors use all kinds of metrics. They take into account the forecast, head coaches, possible postseason play, injuries, weather, inflation, you name it. Even the geeks over at Google are getting into it, and they are forecasting a Seahawks win based on Google searches. Didn't have that years ago, but there might be one key factor that all those pundits might be missing, and that is bedtime. Bedtime for the players. In a study that came out this week in Current Biology, researchers say that an athlete's performance can vary depending on the time of the day. And get this, the time of their peak performance is based on their sleep schedule. Roland Braunstatter is a co-author on that paper, senior lecturer in the Biosciences Department, University of Birmingham in Birmingham, England. Sorry, welcome to Science Friday.
Hello.
Now, you categorized athletes as either early morning larks or night owls by measuring their circadian phenotype. In your study, yeah. what was the sleeping pattern? Tell us about that, of the larks and the owls.
Well, the sleeping patterns are quite different between the larks and the owls. I mean, the larks normally get up at around 7 o'clock in the morning, and they really go to sleep 11 at the latest, if you want. While the larks, if you let them, they will get out of bed at 10, 11, and then not go to bed before, let's say, 1 or 2 a.m.
Right. And there was a pretty significant difference in the peak performance between the larks and the owls? What did you find?
Yeah, the very interesting aspect here is that if you do these performance tests, we did them 6 different times a day from 7 a.m. in the morning until 10 p.m. in the evening, and the early types, the larks, show their maximum, their best performance around midday, while the owls show their best performance around 8 o'clock in the evening, and the intermediates are actually intermediate. They show their best performance around 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Do you think that you could take apart a player's performance as a team and determine their peak time of play and maybe get an advantage that way?
Absolutely. I mean, you have to bear in mind that, you know, each team, I mean, consists of a certain number of early types, intermediate types, and late types. And depending on whether you have a high proportion of owls or a high proportion of larks, the actual team performance peak will be different. I mean, there's absolutely no doubt about that. Because if you have a squad of 20 people and let's say 12 of them are larks and you're playing at 10 in the evening, then you can be sure that you have an impaired team performance because most of them are going to be tired. So I think it plays a very big role.
Do you think that anybody forming any kind of team, coach might take that into account when he or she selects the players on the team?
Well, the question is, if you want to take it that far and say you should consider it when you select your players, of course. But if you look at it from that angle and you think, okay, you know about your competition schedules, you know when your matches are, and it may well be, depending on what kind of sport it is, what kind of league you're playing in, it may be that sometimes you play your matches in the afternoon, sometimes you play your matches in the evening. Here in Europe, it's very common that the match times are very, very different. Or if you're a football team, you play in the afternoon in the Premier League, but then you play in the evening in the Champions League. So it may be very useful, actually, if you have a certain number of larks and a certain number of owls, absolutely.
So you think that if I took apart the Super Bowl teams and I looked at the individual players and could judge somehow whether they're larks or owls, I might find an edge here?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, what you have to bear in mind is, and as far as I followed all of this, and I mean, excuse me if I get any of the facts wrong because I'm sitting here in the UK, but my understanding is that the Super Bowl will start at 4:30 in the afternoon in Phoenix. So the team from Boston is 2 hours ahead. That means for them, actually, the match starts at 6:30. The Seattle players are 1 hour behind, so for them it's actually 3:30 because the internal biological time, what these players have been used to, that's actually most important. That's also something our study shows. Internal biological time is much more important than time of day. So if you look at the length of a game like that, that means for the Boston players it will probably go on until about 10 p.m. in their biological time. For the Seattle players it will be over at around 7, I think. So depending on how many larks, how many owls, there could be actually an advantage for each of them. But then you have to bear in mind that it depends very much when did they actually travel there,
right.
How long have they been there, have they actually readjusted to a new schedule already. That's all facts that I, of course, do not know.
If you went there a week earlier, or is it possible to change a lark into an owl or vice versa?
Well, it is possible, you know, if you have sufficient circadian background knowledge, and that means you know how to entrain and synchronize a biological clock, then you can do it. But I doubt very much that the coaches or the support staff of these teams really has this knowledge. So I guess that they have traveled there, I do not know when, and then they are just in the process of readjusting to a normal schedule. So if they continue to get up in the morning, even after a phase shift, so let's hope none of them are jet-lagged, then still you have the same situations, depending on when they get up in the morning. If they get up at 8 or 9 in the morning, the whole team, then you will still have the larks already being beyond their peak performance when the game starts on Sunday, and the owls just in the process of getting there.
You know, so much of sports is mental. It's a mental game.
Yeah.
So many making mistakes. Is there a difference between when you peak physically versus mentally?
Not really. I mean, physical and mental performance really, you know, go hand in hand to a certain extent. And I think everybody knows that. If you're coming out, if you're a sports person, you're coming out of a really intense training session and you're physically exhausted, then your brain is not on top of its capacity, is it? Then you're just tired. And the same if you're mentally exhausted, you will never ever be on top of your physical performance, will you?
No, that's true. Well, something to let the odds makers consider this week, as I don't think they've ever thought about. Maybe they have. They've thought about when you're at your physical peak and your athletic body clocks. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Absolute pleasure. Bye.
Roland Braunstatter is a senior lecturer in the Biosciences Department, University of Birmingham in Birmingham, England. When you meet somebody, how long does it take for you to form an impression of that person? Just from the face? 5 minutes? 10 minutes? Well, while you're formulating your answer, presented for your consideration is this week's video pick. Our new video on ScienceFriday.com exposes the neurology of how we judge faces. And let me tell you, the findings are eye-opening and a little bit disturbing. And here to talk about it, video producer Lou Groskin. And
hi, there?
Luke. Hi, welcome.
Hi.
Welcome. Hi there. It looks like you're hiding a picture there, Luke. I'm looking for it here.
I am indeed.
Okay.
So no peeking quite yet.
No peeking.
So what I'd like to do is conduct a little experiment of facial perception on you.
Okay, I'm ready.
Okay, so on the count of three, what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you this face that's on this piece of paper. And what you're going to do is you're going to tell me that person's age, gender, race, and maybe its emotional state. Now, our listeners at home can actually go on Twitter and see what this face looks like, so you can actually take this little mini test yourself.
All right, okay. Everybody, ready? Look at Twitter the same time I am.
Okay, so on the here we go. 3, 2, 1.
Wait a minute. You just flashed that up and down so fast, I couldn't see anything.
Yes, but let me ask you. So that person's age, gender, race, can you give me some guesses here?
It was a gender. It was a male.
Okay.
And just a fuzzy bearded, sort of a bearded face.
Was he older?
I'd say middle age.
He was middle age.
Middle age.
And he was male. And was he white? Was he black?
I'm going to say white.
Okay. Well, those are all true. Now, what about his emotional state? Did you get a sense of that?
No, I could not. Could not tell. So it went by so quickly.
Okay. So what I'm here to tell you is that, even though you only saw that face for just a brief millisecond, less than a blink of an eye, you actually judge that face for trustworthy or not trustworthy. Now, I don't know if you find that face trustworthy or not trustworthy, but that in that brief moment, you actually judged it.
I judged it without remembering what the face actually looked like.
Yeah, you may not even be conscious of that sort of decision, of that snap judgment, but you definitely judged it. So our video this week is about a researcher named Dr. John Freeman. And what he's trying to do is he's trying to figure out how and why we make these sort of snap judgments. And what he's looked at in his most recent experiment was trustworthiness. How quickly do we judge a face for its trustworthiness? Mm-hmm. So, and the answer, if you're wondering how fast we actually do it, is 33 milliseconds is what he found.
33 one-thousandths of a second.
33 one-thousandths of a second. That's really fast. That's way faster than the blink of an eye. In fact, that's so fast that in the fMRI experiments that he ran, the subjects that actually saw the face didn't actually know they saw the face.
Yeah, I can understand that because I barely got to see this face. And you flashed it a lot faster because you can't move that quickly.
Exactly.
Like 33 milliseconds.
Exactly. And he knows this because in an fMRI, he can see that the part of your brain that actually makes that sort of call about judgment, about trustworthiness, that lit up. In an fMRI, you can actually see this. There's a little color that flashes on that part of your brain.
And what part of the brain is it flashing in?
It's actually the amygdala.
And the old amygdala.
Our good old amygdala.
Right.
And at the same time, the part of your brain that actually allows you to say, oh, I saw a face, the fusiform cortex, that part didn't light up. So he knew for a fact that these people didn't consciously see the face, but they still had a judgment of that face because their amygdala lit up. Now,
that's like the lizard brain, the early part of our brain.
Exactly. That's the what's typically known as the really hyper-responsive fear center of our brain. So when we see something that's scary, we tend to, you know, our amygdala will light up. Or if we see somebody that's angry at us, then our amygdala will light up. And so the question is, what exactly is going on here? How are you actually able to have a judgment of a face without actually seeing the face? Now, there's a couple of different theories about this. One theory is that, you know, the facial information travels straight to your amygdala. But Dr. Freeman thinks that's not likely. Our amygdala, like you said, is kind of a lizard brain. It needs some more context. What he actually thinks is going on is that the information went from your retinas back to your visual cortex, and then your amygdala, your fast-acting amygdala, started tinting your point of view on it. It started applying emotions, the emotionality of that face, to your judgment of that face.
A face that at baseline structurally resembles an angry expression tends to be seen as untrustworthy. And a face at baseline that structurally resembles a happy expression tends to be seen as trustworthy. And so one idea is that a lot of these personality judgments that we make quite spontaneously are kind of bleeding over from emotion perception. Even on an emotionally neutral face, we sort of see a subtle resemblance to an emotion and then kind of run with that hypothesis.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flato with Luke Ruskin, talking about how quickly that face recognition happens in the amygdala, but not in the place in our brain that we recognize a face.
Exactly, right? Exactly. And that's what Dr. Freeman is most interested in. He wants to know exactly where do these snap decisions come from? How do we form them? How do they act? What are the actual neurological mechanisms that cause us to make snap judgments and make decisions about the different people that we see?
Well, what kind of snap judgments are we making? when we see that little 33 millisecond.
Oh, you well, the 33 milliseconds is just about a trustworthiness. But yes. If you give us a little bit longer and in a different context, we actually can make some pretty distinct real-world judgments. So one of the studies that Dr. Freeman conducted was he took pictures of politicians, male and female politicians, that have run for office and been elected or not elected, and he showed them to people on a computer. And now these people don't know that they're looking at a politician's face. They're just looking at a face. And what he asks them is a very basic question. He says, male or female? Now, our brains are capable of picking up very subtle cues that are kind of gender cues. So, you know, more heavy brows, more, thicker chin, longer chin. These are kind of masculine features. And you could say, the opposite for female features. So in that brief second that you see that face, that politician's face, you have to make a decision and you move your little mouse cursor over to male or female. Now, if you pick male, most of the time, I mean, you pick pretty much all of the time, you pick the right one. But if that politician has slightly different gender cues in their face, you might make a little bit more hesitated move. And what he was doing was tracking your mouse. And so that little hesitated move, that can actually be a predictor of electoral success in conservative states for female politicians.
This was proven.
Yes, yes. So I looked at the significance of the results here, and I'm willing to put money in a conservative state for a female politician that if you saw that the gendered cues of her face are can allow you to predict her electoral success.
Wow. You're not betting real money. That's a figure of speech.
No, I would bet based on the study, I would actually bet the real money. And that gives you pause. It's pretty well known even in scientific communities that the attractiveness of a politician, especially a female politician, can weigh on their electability. And that's a sad state of our political system and perhaps of how we judge faces. Mm. But the notion that within 300 milliseconds of seeing a politician's face, you're actually making a decision that could downstream affect their electability, that's pretty big.
Luke Groskin, our video producer, you can watch our video called FaceTime. It's up on sciencefriday.com, and you can take it with you on our app if you like. And you can also get our weekly videos just by clicking the subscribe button beneath the video player. Thank you, Luke.
Thank you.
That's about all the time we have for today. BJ Lederman composed our theme music, and our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. If you missed any part of the program, you'd like to hear it again, you can subscribe to our podcasts, audio, video podcasts. Point your tablet or your smartphone to our website at sciencefriday.com, where you can also join our mailing list. And if you like us, like us on Facebook, too, where we continue a week-long discussion. And we're on all week tweeting, also, @SciFry. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.